The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand. Join the Hyundai revolution. The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai. Everyone's talking about the revolution driven by Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand.
Hello there, and a very good morning to you. And you're very welcome indeed to the programme this morning. A little chillier this morning than it was yesterday, but wherever you are, I hope you're having a very nice weekend this Easter Sunday. Now, we start today with the Sunday Independent. There are a couple of polls out today. Gilmore on the rack as Labour sinks to 6%. Polls reveal majority want Kenny to dump Shatter over Garda scandals. The other story is fresh insight into the night that haunts us. And there was a big long account in yesterday's Irish Times of who was at that meeting in government buildings that night, who kept notes of it, who didn't. I noticed that according to the article, that the civil servants didn't keep notes, but that some of the bankers, and clearly one that was a former Attorney General, did. The Sunday Business Post: coalition war rages over water. Now the fraud squad is to probe Quinn dealings, and suspected child abusers can be told accuser's identity. Now, the Sunday, I don't seem to have the Sunday Times to hand, or do I? Anyway, the Sunday World, Desperate Dan. This is to do with drugs and a drugs haul and money. The Irish Mail: on Sunday we paid bus bribes too. And on the Irish Sun on Sunday, they have Bob, my amazing daughter. And while I'm hoping everybody's going to have a great weekend today and tomorrow, it's going to be a very tough day for that family. The church in question, from which she will be buried, is where she was baptised, where she was married. It's where her parents got married, and it's from where her mother was buried. So there's a lot of history in that churchyard for that particular family, and it'll be a very difficult time for them. And I know that a lot of people will be very sympathetic to them. Now, Sunday Times last. Garda scandal hits Fine Gael in the polls. This is the other poll I was talking about. Easter Rising descendant calls for pardon before the royal visit, and the South Korean ferry hero gave her life to save school children. Well, that's just... Oh, and the other thing I just meant to mention, there's a photograph inside in the Irish Mail on Sunday. Well, two, actually, on the one page, of Brian Boru and the commemoration for Brian Boru out in Clontarf yesterday. And there's an enormous crowd there. I didn't actually know that people were that passionate about Brian Boru still. But anyway, clearly they are. And I guess that's no bad thing. Anyway, with us in studio this morning are Niall Harbison, a digital entrepreneur, one of those guys that did something that nobody understands in a bedroom, you know, and ended up making a mint out of it, for which congratulations. Philip McCabe, manager of Citizens Information Services in County Monaghan. Noreen Hegarty, managing destination editor with Lonely Planet and former editor of the Sunday Tribune. Jim Power, an economist, and Sinead O'Carroll of the journal.ie. And you are all very welcome indeed into studio. I suppose we'd have to start with the polls, because I'd imagine that our politicians are poring over them anyway. Noreen?
Yeah, we're still some way out from a general election, so I think they have to come with a health warning.
Yeah.
There's some discrepancy between, you know, certainly where Labour is at in the Sunday Independent poll at 6% and where they are in the Sunday Times poll at 9%. Now, 9% is closer to Labour's traditional vote of around 10 to 12%. Wouldn't be so concerning. 6%, I'm sure, would put the heart crossways in anybody who's a Labour minister. Fine Gael up 2% to 29% in the Sunday Independent poll, but just at 21%. in the Sunday Times, and they make the point that Fine Gael is down 9 percentage points in the last 2 months, which they are relating to the penalty points, Garda Commissioner Alan Shatter, all of that stuff. Quite substantial. And I think, you know, in the context where you have issues coming up, and they're in all of the papers today about water charges, Phil Hogan being in the front line, James Riley, the health issue, and drugs again are back in the headlines about the price of pharmaceutical drugs in Ireland. And then you have all of the other attendant problems with the economy, with Michael Noonan supposedly standing up against any, you know, dilution of the line in relation to austerity. Yeah. So I think there would be reasons to be fearful and reasons to be concerned. And
you would have to say that if you were a Labour, mind you, it's the story repeated over and over again. Like, if you mentioned there, you said James Riley, Phil Hogan and Alan Shatter. Like, they're the ones that are in trouble. Well, not
the
in
least
trouble.
Popular,
the least
say,
popular.
Yeah.
And Labour go down in the polls. Like, there seems certain lack of justice in that, Sinead.
Really interesting, but just to finish up with this, Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin are kind of steady in both polls, around the 22%. And Charlie Flanagan is making the point about the Sinn Féin fear factor in the Sunday Independent. And that's actually really interesting in light of 1916 and all the other things we're going to be talking
about. The possibility of a Fianna Fáil Sinn Féin coalition.
Yeah, with you were saying about Labour kind of taking the brunt of what it's actually Fine Gael ministers, and I think it's the handling of the issues. It's not the actual penalty points issue. It's not the Martin Callanan resignation. It's the handling of it. It's Alan Shatter, how he's managed it or not managed it. But yeah, it's still Labour who are seen not to be standing up, maybe, and people expect Labour to be standing up for them, and they're not doing that as people want.
Right. Jabbar?
Yeah, I mean, the Fine Gael one is really interesting because the biggest collapse, I think, in poll history, according to Behaviours and Attitudes, the Sunday Times, down 9%. But then in the Sunday Indo, they're up 2% to 29% if you strip out the undecided. There's a lot of undecideds out there. The independents are doing very, very well.
They're doing terrifically well.
They're doing terrifically well, yeah. I have a friend who's running as an independent in the local elections in Terenure Tembeloge, and on the doorstep, there's a lot of negativity, particularly about Labour, but there's also quite a bit about Fine Gael. And it's not because of what they're doing with the economy. I mean, the general view is things are starting to get a little bit better.
You were writing about that yourself today.
Moving in the right direction. But it's the lack of sort of ability to tackle these problems and solve them, get them out of the way. I mean, the Shatter thing has been going on and on.
And will go on.
It will
further.
Go on. It was only taken off the media really by Michael Dee's visit to the United Kingdom. That sort of detracted attention for a moment, but it's coming back again, and the government's handling of it has been poor. I'm not sure what Alan Shatter has done wrong, but there is a point, I think, in politics, and if anybody watches stuff like House of Cards or Borgen, when a politician, regardless of the ability of the position, becomes a liability to government, they're generally discarded. And I think that's becoming the situation for Alan Shatter, for right or for wrong. He's definitely becoming a bit of a liability, and it is being reflected in the polls. Obviously, the Fine Gael and Labour hope would be that over the next couple of years,
short memories,
you know, and the economy starts to come back in 2 years' time, you would expect more people to be working in the economy. You would expect things to be somewhat better than they are today, which are certainly better than they were 2 years ago, and that will pay an electoral dividend. Mm. But it's tough times for Labour at the moment, which is typical of a small government and coalition, a small party.
Yeah.
Sinn Féin factor as well. The other controversy, the PAC and the Frank Flannery connection with Fine Gael. And the Mary Lou McDonald is the one who's coming out as the shining light in that. She's been the one that tackled it. She's been the one who's really got the headlines and grabbed the public's attention as really handling that issue and getting kind of to trying to get to the centre of what happened.
Mm. I think as well, though, that people expect that the economic crisis has been very difficult, and there's an understanding of that. But there isn't a sense that anything is translating to their pockets currently. Mm. It may well do.
Or it may translate out of their pockets if they're out of the water.
It might, exactly. But there's no sense of reform. There's no sense of that promise that things were going to be different, that this government were coming in with fresh eyes and a new attitude. And it kind of feels like more of the same.
Same old, yeah.
I think that's the biggest, what you just hit the nail on the head there. But one thing I am right about the polls, these polls really tickle my fancy greatly because they go up and down. It, you know, it depends which paper you read and which week you read it. It's either up or down.
But you look at trends as well, you know.
But I'm just wondering, if a general election was called in the morning, Will that poll, will those polls be reflected in a general election? I often wonder about it, because you give the hype of a 6-2 months lead into a general election. That's the way I look at things. And say, I wonder how it, because we'd have 2 months then of brainwashing the people again as to what everybody was going to do and where would we be, and would the polls be reflected? But the discrepancy between the 2% and the 9% is quite large. I mean, that is quite big. But at the moment, the perception out there with people is, like, I see it in our office, people come in and they're in difficulty all the time, and the water charges and the property tax, the latest one, the property tax, that's what we haven't even mentioned, but people wonder, they're still wondering about the payout. I was saying to Jim earlier, the revenue, people paid it last year, and they're wondering, is it automatically taken out of my bank account this year, or did I set it up, or what did they do? So there's a lot of people, that's going on at the moment.
There was a lot of confusion around that, and the more it was clarified, the more confusing it got. Yeah. People were paying it last year for next year and all that kind
If you look, Marion, at what people are facing at the moment, I mean, we mentioned the fact that the economy is moving in a better direction.
Yeah.
But if you look at what people are doing these couple of months, I know my own personal situation, you get the full year property tax bill. Health insurance costs have gone up dramatically again.
Shot up.
I mean, it's a massive amount of disposable income taken out of people's pockets.
Yeah.
You have the
after tax.
After tax, exactly. And you have the controversy, and I suppose what the government did in last year's budget, tackling the so-called gold-plated health insurance policies, which was a total fiasco. You know, that's now starting to hit people really hard in the pockets. And then you have the issue about the water charges, and there's quite a bit in the papers today about that. But
there is a lot
in the papers. Yeah, there's a lot.
Yeah, but didn't we know from the outset? Sorry, I haven't. What's your take on all these, or do you care?
I guess, being an entrepreneur, I try and ignore politics as much as possible.
because I wish I could.
Yeah. and I think just coming at it from a business side, I think we've definitely taken the medicine and we've been through the worst of it. I think just seeing, you know, lots of businesses hiring lots of people, we're starting to get through the worst of it. That's obviously not translating into the man on the street or the woman on the street paying their bills and still struggling financially. But I think those polls are a reflection. If you come back in 2 years, they've saved all the good news up and all the nice financial stuff to, in the lead into the election, I would imagine, and they'll come good in the polls. That would be a non-political.
Yeah, but if you do go back to when you were talking about personal bills, for people at all kinds of, there's even universal social charge, that hit much harder than people realised when it was announced. Then you have, if you're going to do private health insurance, then you have your water charge, then you have your property charges. Like, there's a lot of taxes
and I think
have come in.
One of the huge issues as well is we're now in April and we don't, other than leaks through the media, households don't know what they're going to be paying for everything next year. So we're talking about budgeting and people don't know what they're budgeting for yet. It's not exactly great economics, I would imagine.
Jim makes that point today as well. And it's, no matter what way you call it a tax, call it a cut, whatever, it's siphoning off money from people all the time.
Yeah,
the middle income group, as I would call them, Marion, even the civil and public servants. Now, we are getting queries from those people at the moment. Universal social charge, the water charges, the household property, and the insurance. When you put them all together, like, I've talked to people whose monthly wages have gone down so dramatically, it's scary. It really is scary. And we're getting to a stage now where the people who can't afford, see, it's all bitty. There's too many bits in it. If it were a case, I was telling Jim earlier, I can remember, Marion, please excuse me, prior to 77, when I paid £650 a year rates. Now, for that, I got a terrific service. I didn't like paying the rates, but a great service. Now,
what did you get?
Well, I got everything. See, at that time, we had very good roads at that time. At the time, I felt we had everything we're talking about now, we had then, you see. And
refuse charges.
And all that. Yeah, it was all done. There was no problem at all. Everything was. I thought, we didn't like paying it. Now, the government changed in 77. Jack Lynch came in with a sweeping majority in Louth, where I was living at, and I'm still living there. But there was Fianna Fáil, the three Fs, Faulkner, Filgate and Farrell were elected for Fianna Fáil. Now, in one of the papers, Mary Cairns was talking in one of the papers, but the voters aren't being stupid. I would say, yes, we were all very stupid in 77 because we voted to bring in, to do away with the rates because it suited us all. So to say, and here we are, and we're still living the legacy of that, I would say, even to this day, because we've had several downturns in the economy in the last 30, 40 years. And every one of them, Jim mightn't agree with me, maybe he does agree.
I totally agree with you, 100%. And I said to you inside that 77 manifesto is an abject lesson for anybody that should never put an economist in charge of anything. You know, that whole manifesto was written by an economist at the time.
But it really was buying the electorate.
And it was incredibly successful. But the
rates were hated. Well, at least they were hated in our house.
Yeah, sure. We're hated everywhere. But I look at the situation now in Northern Ireland. I have relations up there. And you pay between 1,000 and 2,000 sterling for your rates in Northern Ireland. And you get a very good service. Everything's included in that, including health, by and large, as far as I can gather from up there. And they don't like paying it, but they have very good service. So instead of us having all these bitty ones, like the water charge, the property tax, the USA, put them all together into one bucket and say, this is what you pay and this is the service we're going to give you for it. We'll solve a lot of problems, I think.
I think you have to expect that you're going to pay property charges, you're going to pay water charges. People all over Europe do, people in the UK do. I think for us, the one difference is the universal social charge.
That's it.
And that's a particularly cruel and biting charge, and everybody is hit by it, no matter how low your income is. And I think that's the one differential at the moment, that, you know, if that was removed, that would make a big difference. We will have to pay for all the other things in future. That's the reality. You pay council tax in the UK, it can be anything up to £2,000 a year, depending on which borough you're living in London, which is where I'm aware of it.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
What do you pay in London?
Well, depending on where you're living in London, different boroughs have different charges for council tax, but it can be quite expensive
and
if you're living in one of the top boroughs.
Do you know what it is in your own?
Off the top of my head, I don't, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
But you do pay council tax, you do pay water charges, which come in around £400, something like that, a year.
Sterling.
In Ireland, Marianne, people, I had to travel a bit on the continent, and they can't gank it over when we have 3 weeks of sunshine here. We have to preserve our water. I mean, the water's coming out of the sky here for us.
It's
lack of investment.
Correct.
And it goes back to that 77 situation.
Correct. I mean,
local authority financing has never been on a solid footing since then.
There's a great story in the Mail today about one apartment block in Santry where they brought in water meters and they discovered that if they hadn't brought them in, they would be paying £80,000 a year in water charges, such as the level of leaks in that apartment block. Mm. And that's our difficulty. And it's going to be another 12 years before the local authority handed over. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So we're going to have that problem ongoing. And
before we leave it, I mean, is this old grandstanding, do you think, Sinead, about Labour saying, you know, that they object to the water? We knew we were going to get hit with water.
Yeah, and we're 30 something odd days out from the locals. And that Labour and Fine Gael being at such loggerheads about it. Yes, we did know we were paying. And I think Fine Gael voters don't have huge objections to paying for water either. There's kind of a general feeling out there that yes, we do have to pay, but I think Labour are definitely trying to stick up for.
And before I leave it, where would you place the figure? We've had 248, we've had 400, and I see a headline in one of the things today of 600 households could face 600 in water charges. That's in the Sunday Business.
Okay, the 248 that was mooted last week, I suspect it's going to come in roughly
on that
initially.
Yeah.
The story from Michael Brennan, the Sunday Business Post, was making the point that at the moment and for the foreseeable future, the government is going to be subventing Irish Water, the company, okay? And that's going to keep the water charge down. But once that government subvention ends, which Phil Hogan has promised it will, that at that stage, Irish Water will start hiking the price we pay.
And then
they will blame the regulator, absolutely.
Yeah. You could write the script, absolutely.
Yeah. I think there's a general sense out there, and I think it's related to another story about rural development we're going to be talking about, I think, later on.
Yeah.
But people are paying all these different types of taxes and charges, and they're questioning what you get in return. I was down in Waterford yesterday, rural Waterford, out for a walk, and the roads are diabolical. I mean, I saw something on social media last weekend in the Ukraine. An artist has started planting daffodils in potholes in the roads. Fabulous photograph. But in Waterford, you could actually plant oak trees at the moment.
Yeah, well, I think that's more or less the same all,
well, it's the same all over. So that's what makes people really peed off about paying all this money. What are we getting in return?
But one of the starting articles in that piece by Michael Brennan in that it is the entire cost, it's £1.1 billion. That's what the water's costing us. I mean, a startling figure, £1.1 billion for water in Ireland. I mean, there's something wrong.
I don't think it's the water. I think it's getting it fit for drinking.
And getting it
in pipes that don't leak 40% of it,
The allocation before you pay, though, is kind of scary too. Willie Keeley has a piece on that in the Sunday Independent. It's what you're allowed is 2 flushes of the toilet a day, 1 shower and a brush of the teeth. Doesn't seem adequate to me.
What about a cup of tea?
Pay for that, you see. This is what you're allowed. And if you have, you know, a lot of people in a family, and certainly if you have teenagers or whatever, you know, they're going to use an awful lot more water than that.
Were talking about Ireland, and why not move on to that? Pat Spillane is involved.
I have that piece done this morning. I vote Pat Spillane should take the government over. That's what I'm voting after reading this. Because Pat and his team of CEDRA, is that what they're called? Commission for the Economic Development of Rural Areas. And reading through it now, he has a few very interesting facts here I found worrying anyway. Like he said, 72% of Ireland is rural, which is, well, we all understand that.
Well, 72% physically, but not in population
terms. But he's actually said, he then goes on to say that the number of farmers, and takes the farmers and the rest of the people, are make up the rural area. But what he's saying is, he asked three questions, if I can find them there. At the meeting, there were three questions put, and I had them tipped here a minute ago. Now I can't even find them in my bit of loads of paper here, what they were to do. But the questions that were asked was, you know, for the people to come up with their own answers, start at grassroots and work it the other way. At the moment, he was saying it's coming top down.
Yeah.
And he said there's no joined up thinking, that there's no one government department has responsibility for rural learning. None. There's all over the place. Yeah. So he was saying that that would be a start. Get some sort of organisation locally to start on at a grassroots level and work its way up. As I said, everything comes down the hill from central government to us.
And Niall, you were looking at that story too, weren't you?
I was. I'd come at it from another point of view. I think, like rural Ireland is incredibly important, but we've managed to attract some of the biggest companies in the world here, Facebook, Google. And if you, for the past 18 months, if you walk through town, every single restaurant is packed, every single the shops are all busy. And I think that's, you know, the tens of thousands of young professionals who are coming to work here. So that's brilliant, but we're definitely at a stage where there's sort of a two-stage recovery and a two-stage economy. There's Dublin and the rest of Ireland, and that's a fact. And how you push some of the money into rural Ireland is very, very important. But
I thought that the Pat Spillane thing was that you started, like you did yourself, you know, that you do it yourself and that you don't have to be in. Would you have, well, you would have needed broadband, but would you have been able to do what you did with your companies if you lived in a small village or out the country?
Absolutely not. Like, you, in theory, you could. You only need broadband. But the network is here in Dublin. The advertisers are here. This is the same in the UK. The London is where it's at. I mean, it's a shame for rural Ireland, and we need to find solutions. But no, you couldn't do it outside Dublin.
It's interesting you could say you could do it because you'd have broadband, but actually you might not have broadband in rural areas. Our tech writer had spoke to 250 homes in Cork who have no access to broadband right now. There's loads of pockets in rural Ireland and that's a problem for students in school who are pretty much expected to use online tools for their work now. So you're starting at a disadvantaged level from way earlier.
That's right. I think everything that you do in college now, you do.
And through school, primary school, secondary school, you're expected to be online and use tools.
I think Niall made a good point there about this. It is not unique to Ireland. I mean, the UK economy has totally surpassed on the upside over the last couple of years, but it's been the Greater London area.
Yeah.
Here in Dublin, it's the Greater Dublin, or sorry, here in Ireland, it's the Greater Dublin area. But even in Germany, there's a strong migration from the countryside to the cities. So it happens everywhere. I think what you have to do, and I mean, if you look at what's happening in rural Ireland at the moment, you know, the Gardaí presence has been reduced dramatically. So law and order is a huge issue. Stuff like local creameries are gone. The IT infrastructure is dreadful. The roads are dreadful. Health service is pretty dreadful. You know, if you're
but you can't have a Mayo Clinic in every.
No, you cannot. But those are the realities. So what you have to do, I think, is look at what strengths rural Ireland has. You know, and they stand out. Tourism is a massive strength. The agri-food industry is a
massive
strength.
That's the biggest one, Jim.
It is indeed.
The biggest one.
You've got to focus in on those and try and generate local economies, I think, from the ground up.
But you've also got to think about us as being a society, not just an economy. Because if you take out the post offices from rural towns, if you know, if the schools are gone, there's no focus for the community. If the Garda stations aren't there, and there is the argument that you don't need to see guards walking on the street, but you do need a station that's open, that you can feel there's a security within the community. You can call on somebody if you
need to.
Totally
agree,
And I think that's where. But it also means if you want a passport and you've got your form signed, that you don't have to kind of get a bus or a lift from from a neighbour, that kind of thing. But then again, I suppose you can't have one of those in every crossroads either.
But I think broadband is absolutely essential. I mean, I'm in an environment where, you know, we employ about 400 people who work from home, who obviously have to have very good broadband facilities. A lot of businesses, even when you're talking about all the high tech companies, there are opportunities to for people to work from home in those environments. The new way is, once you have your laptop or your tablet, you don't need to be at an office necessarily, or you can check in with an office a couple of times a week. So that should open up opportunities for people to live where they choose to live, as opposed to just in urban centres.
Yeah.
But if there isn't a really good broadband service, that's not even an option.
A really good example is, I don't know if you guys know, the Collison brothers, who set up a company called Stripe. So that's they're young Irish guys. The company's valued at $2 billion. They'll probably sell it one day for $50 billion. That's the road it's heading. They came from a little rural part of just outside Limerick, and luckily enough, their parents when they were growing up had enough foresight to get satellite broadband in. So that's how they were able to start accessing the internet. But the point is that the structures weren't there for them, so they cleared off straight away to Silicon Valley, which is unfortunate. So I think if you could start a business from anywhere in Ireland, and I think that's the one of the ways of getting rural Ireland back on track. But the reality is, broadband's just one piece of it. If you want the network and the support and the funding and all the other things that come with starting a business, it has to be in Dublin.
And the old human contact too, you know. Tell people what it was that your first success, so to speak.
It was a business called Simply Zesty. So we just set it up, myself and Lauren, who's a female entrepreneur, the two of us in my spare bedroom, and we had about 10 grand in cash, I think. And I actually remember I was out in TV3 the morning after the bank guarantee. So that's when we were setting the business up, and I saw all these politicians, and I was like, this is probably not a great time to be doing it. That's one way of looking at it. Or the other way is, it's maybe the best time to be setting it up. So,
and what is it?
That one we sold to UTV. It was a social media agency. So we just helped big brands and organisations implement social media. So 2008, 2009, when not many people knew what it was.
And this was helping large companies to use it to their commercial advantage.
Yeah, so if you look at the media landscape over the last 3 or 4 years, it's completely changed. So it's everything's moved to social media. I'd argue that the biggest change is mobile. Everybody's walking around with a smartphone, you know, which is a computer in their pocket. So for large media organisations, large brands, to understand that transition and make sense of it, and most of them still haven't, we were able to offer a service there.
And the next one?
A company called PR Slides, which I'm doing at the moment, which is based in Dublin. And two aims. One, we're going to try and become a big global technology platform. Two aims. One, it was started by Emma, so I'm very passionate about female entrepreneurs in Ireland. I don't think they get enough backing, and that maybe they don't back themselves enough, so they need to be pushed forward. And the other is to try and build a global technology platform from Dublin. So all these big companies come into Ireland, Google, Facebook and all that. That's brilliant. That's going to employ a certain type of people. But why can't we do that from Ireland and employ developers and people who actually make stuff here, rather than just having companies here for tax reasons?
Right. And what does the company do?
It's in media. So we source images for the media to download from brands. So it's a platform that connects brands with journalists. I should really have the 10 second pitch.
The brands pay to get it on the platform, and then the media take it for free.
Exactly.
Right.
And then I've got a little blog called Love in Dublin, which helps people find out stuff about the city. So kind of at the intersection of media and technology, which is a really exciting place to be. There's opportunity and there's also decimation in equal measures across media at the moment.
Right. I looked at your TED. We did a little section on the programme yesterday on the TED Talks, and we had done it a while ago as well, because they're just fantastic. And I was looking at your own one last night. And you know, there can be failure and success, and you just get on with it.
Yeah, what I didn't mention, that was all the good stuff. What I didn't mention is my first business was called iFoods, and we raised €500,000 and we made a balls of it and lost all the investors' money and didn't make a penny. And that was, that's another thing that needs to be encouraged in Ireland, is to dismiss the fear of failure. Yeah. If I was in Ireland or in America recently, they won't invest. Investors won't invest in you unless you've had at least one failure.
You'll have learned, you'll have manners on you, kind of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Sorry.
I would say as well that it's about the management style. I mean, I worked in Ireland for a very long time in media, and the management style, I would view it now as being still very old-fashioned, very 80s style in terms of the hierarchy of it, and sometimes the tyranny of it. You know, and what you need is a new management style. I mean, in Lonely Planet, we have agile methodology, which comes from developers, which essentially enables the team to take responsibility for different things. You have stand-up meetings, you have a thing called a retro every week, where people come in with what they're happy about, what they're unhappy about. It's a very open forum. There is no judgment. And the idea being that you can try things, you can fail, you can reverse out, you can start again, and you're very flexible. It began in Utah about 12 years ago with developers, because obviously they're project-led.
But when you say developers, how do you mean?
No, software developers. You know, that is where things are at in media. I spend an awful lot of my time now working with developers, because the platform that you're on is essential. The content is one thing and the quality of it, but that you're on the right platform, and as you say, on mobile, and on all the late, all the new social interest sites, because things are moving so rapidly that it's not just Facebook, and in fact the younger generation are moving off Facebook very rapidly. So it's to be in touch with all that. So it's actually a very exciting time for media, provided you're prepared to be agile and flexible.
Well, I mean, Sinead, you were kind of involved in groundbreaking there. How is the Journal doing?
We're doing great, and I think Niall kind of hit the nail on the head with the mobile aspect of media, and having a computer in your phone, or having a computer and kind of being a place to go for information, and that's where the journal.ie sits. It sits on people's phone and also on tablets, which has actually broadened the age demographic of where our readership is. It's not just the 20s and 30s who are reading, it's people. We have huge tablet ownership in Ireland amongst an older generation who will use the Journal for their news gathering and for other things as well.
Right.
I don't know your stats off the top of my head, but I'm guessing more than half of the people access the Journal via mobile. Or around that.
I don't have figures off the top of my head. But we would be. It's mobile driven. Yeah. People are standing at bus stops. It's not necessarily. You're not necessarily rivaling papers. You're kind of. You want to be the thing that people open when they take out their phones at the bus stop.
As I get the bus into town early mornings, first thing I do is go into the Journal, run down through the stories.
Really? You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
The thing that's noticeable now, Martin, is the young kids. I mean, when I say young kids, there's kids now at 6 and 7, maybe even earlier, but I see them now have their mobile phones or whatever they have in front of them. I'm amazed when I say that. Sorry, I'm on the grave and on the grayer side of vintage. But when I look at kids in supermarkets and the mommy's pushing a trolley and there's a toddler, a 4 or 5, and they're there and they're looking and they're footing with this. So to stop them from pulling the stuff off the shelves, I suspect.
And it works, I gather.
It absolutely does. So you can imagine their brain. This is what I'm thinking. Their brain, what is it going to be like in 4 or 5 years' time? That's what it's
like. I know of a household where there was a little chap who's about 10 months.
Oh my God.
And sitting up in his high chair, right? And there was an iPad in front of him. He couldn't talk, like he had only had about 10 or 12 words, but he could get it to do things that he wanted it to do.
Yeah, they know how to swipe. It's kind of intuitive now. They know, like, if it's a screen, I can touch it and it'll do something. It'll change colour or it'll talk to me. It'll do something. It's very intuitive.
It's a whole generation now, and I think maybe we have a couple of generations now that have no intimidation with technology. Yeah. You know, there's nothing that they fear about it. And in fact, it's a fantastic tool to develop. The one thing I would say, though, working kind of in a global environment now, is that languages are key to our development as well. Mm-hmm. That people speak a number of different languages, because you go into Europe, you go into the rest of the world, and we're not teaching our kids at a young enough age to speak European languages.
Right, yeah, or Chinese.
Or Chinese, exactly.
Arabic, other kinds of things. Anyway, we're a long way from what Pat's plan. I'd say you haven't cheered him up an awful lot.
Well, I would say three questions I find them was: what are the opportunities for jobs? How can job opportunities be realised, and what are the challenges? And there are three basic questions at local level. Now, again, the broadband at the local level would help. But our exports at the moment, if you look at what they are, it's by and large coming from the agricultural side. Now, that's one side.
He wants to specifically exclude farmers.
He does. Because farmers will exist.
Because they'll be getting on with what they do.
Yeah, but he was saying, like, if you take on another area.
He's wrong.
Well, maybe he is.
Why is he wrong?
I think farmers have to be part of the equation. I mean,
but they're going to farm anyway.
Well, no, not necessarily in the same way, because you know, farmers cannot be left in isolation now to just produce what they produce. They have got to be tied into the food chain. You know, they really have. And I know some really successful agri-food companies around the country. Flavins, for example, down home.
Yeah.
You know, they have a fantastic relationship developed with the farmers who supply them with the oats. You know, I think the farmer has got to become much more proactive and brought into the whole food chain.
Mm.
And that's where the future of farming is, in my view, because I just don't believe farmers, the next generation of farmers, are going to continue to do what they've always done for nothing.
But I have to add the bit.
Sorry,
Emma Kennedy in the Business Post today, she mentioned there's 100,000 students will apply this year for SUSE, for the students' grants.
Yeah.
Now, that's quite a substantial figure. But if it's a case we don't start producing more jobs, Dublin can only produce so many. We can do so much. Those 100,000 students in a couple of years are going to be gone on us. And the idea of getting something down at a local level, we've got to do something at a local level, because we can't all confine themselves to Dublin or the bigger urban areas. We need, like, if we had broadband, what Niall is doing could be done by somebody else. Hopefully, a try down.
Another way of looking at it is, like, we pay lots of money from our taxes to support organisations like Enterprise Ireland and the IDA, and they're doing a fantastic job. No other country has organisations that are doing that, the work that they're doing, by bringing Google, Facebook, Airbnb. That's Irish people going over and shaking hands and saying, come move to Ireland and bring your large business here. But every single one of those companies is based in Dublin. So so I'd be asking, if I was from the country, I'd be saying, look, what can we do to get some of these big companies, yes, coming to Ireland, but based in Cork, based in Galway, based in Waterford.
Well, Cork did well on the pharmaceuticals.
Yeah,
but I mean, Galway and Waterford, and they haven't really done.
Galway does well in the life sciences. It's doing very well, actually. And I mean, Craig Ann have been one of the indigenous examples of a really successful business, but Waterford, just a lot of it, Limerick hasn't done great. A lot of the
Westport
areas haven't done.
Has a pharmaceutical.
It has Baxter and all those companies up there. There's Allergan. There's
Allergan has been there for quite a while.
It has been there for a long time.
I think it's a catch 22. Going back to what Noreen was saying about society as well, and the idea of we're kind of missing a huge generation at the moment with the amount of 20 somethings that have got educated and left. And they're not just going to Dublin. Like, people have left and gone to other countries as well. So we are kind of ruining the fact that we have lost a generation there. And, you know, it's easy to get people to come to Dublin, where there's a vibrant community of young, educated people, but it's a bit of a harder sell when those numbers are dwindling elsewhere.
But we shouldn't give up on the rural Ireland thing, because if you look at, I'm being very parochial out again, but down where I come from, companies like Flavins, Dawn Meats, they're employing thousands of people at this stage in the agri-food business, doing really well. And that to me is the future for around those sorts of businesses.
Well, more probably could be done in those areas to ensure that the 20-something stay, that they don't feel a draw elsewhere, or that they do feel a draw and then come back. That there's enough society, there's enough things happening.
Or that we identify what we're really good at. I mean, we're really good at technology now. We're really good at attracting the Facebooks, the Googles, the Airbnbs, Twitter. And they're based in Dublin. So identify what we can be really good at in rural Ireland and set up the university courses that lead people into that area. You know, attract people from abroad to come and study here. And I don't know necessarily what those things are. I'm thinking
Finland.
In terms of the arts, where, you know, we're really good at literature. We're really good at, we have a really strong history in terms of that. You know, is that something that could be in rural Ireland? But yeah, there are better brains than mine that can think of what these things are. But things that we can do better than anyone else in the world, because that's where the future is. It's in those niches.
Yeah. Niall, did Enterprise Ireland help you?
They did, in this current business, they did, and I wouldn't say a bad word about them. I think they provide some financial help, but it's more the supports and networks and the work that they do overseas in terms of introductions and stuff like that really helps.
Right.
And if you go to Belgium or the UK or any of these other, like, those sort of supports are not there for entrepreneurs. We're actually very entrepreneurial friendly here in Ireland, so that's brilliant, and long may it continue.
Indeed. Sorry.
No, just to say that I'd be worried now, to follow on with that 100,000 students who are applying for grants, that they wouldn't be leaving the next generation go as well. So we need to do something somewhere. And if we have the city pretty well covered, but if we do something in rural Ireland, but starting at grassroots and asking the people themselves what they can do down there, because this I don't think has been done before in any degree. You have people talking down to them, all right, but not talking up. So I give Pat Spillane 10 out of 10 for this effort.
Yeah, well, I mean, we all wish him well. Yeah. I mean, but the interesting thing to see
how
how it works out. But that thing about there are pockets, and there seriously are pockets where you cannot get broadband at all.
Yeah,
it's hugely problematic. Yeah.
I actually happen to be going after the programme to a place where you can't even get a mobile phone call.
That's a good thing to get out.
You can make that a virtue. If you were in France,
you wouldn't be allowed to take a work phone call or take an email after 6 p.m. in certain sectors. And
yeah, that article. It's
Paul Anthony McDermott.
Just remind people what it's about.
So he's talking about this column is to be read for leisure only on Easter Sunday. So if we brought in similar rules here that you wouldn't be allowed to check your emails after 6 p.m. or you wouldn't be allowed to take work phone calls, and the idea of kind of sticking to your 48-hour work week because, you know,
48-hour
you're going somewhere else.
Yes. it's against the law.
It's in certain sectors. There's only about 200,000 people in France who are actually going to be impacted by this, I think.
IT and consultancy are two of the areas.
What do you think of that?
I think it's pie in the sky. I like the theory, but in practice, I just can't see how you could possibly implement that because, you know, the reality of corporate culture as it has developed is that it becomes all consuming. You know, there was a time, and Paul Anthony McDermott talks about, if you worked in a coal mine, it would be very difficult to bring your work home with you.
Yes.
But when you're working in many of the modern businesses, your work is with you 24 hours a day. You know, the first thing people do in the morning is check the emails, etc. So I think impossible to police that sort of
it goes
situation.
Back to having a computer in your pocket with your phone.
Yeah.
But it also comes back to, you know, societies versus economies.
Yeah.
I mean, the French are quite determined to maintain their own way of life.
Well, I was in Brussels last weekend on Sunday and everything closes in Brussels on Sunday. They still have that. Oh, it was like being in Ireland in the 1950s. Nothing, the shops, everything. Yeah. Nothing is open.
I rather like that.
I think this law is somewhat unrealistic because people, I mean, speaking for myself, I work in different time zones all the time. So you may need to do a Skype at 6 o'clock in the morning with Australia and you may need to do stuff in the evening with the West Coast of America. And that's the new reality. What it also allows, though, is a flexibility because, you know, if you need to do something during the day, you're not stuck to this old fashioned at your desk from 9 to 5 or 5:30 or whatever it used to be. You know, so it does give a freedom. And I think the only stress is when things are out of control. If you maintain it in your control, I would find it very stressful if I couldn't check my emails. I would get really uptight about that. And if I couldn't take a phone call.
And what would you be Skyping Australia for at 6 o'clock in the morning?
Well, I work for Lonely Planet. So we have our product bases in Australia where the guidebooks are put together and published. And we still do 10 guidebooks a month. So, and then trading reference books. Yes, it's a declining part of the business, but it's still a very important part of the business. And then I would be working with the headquarters in Nashville, Tennessee, and also with our office in Oakland in San Francisco. And there would be, I mean, you know, we're dealing with a multitude of issues from balance and objectivity to editorial to various different products to working with developers very closely to ebooks to mobile, which is a huge element of our business currently, to magazines. Well, to having apps, to having the right apps for the right destinations. And we've acquired two businesses very relatively recently, one called Tourist Eye in Spain, which is very good on mobile, and they're helping us enormously with our technology. And then another called budgettravel.com based in New York, which is very good on the magazine end of it, and we do a magazine published in 13 different languages. So again, we're learning a lot from all
a magazine.
So
how often is it published?
Monthly.
And it's travel issues.
Yes, yeah, Lonely Planet Traveller.
Right.
Yeah. So,
what do you think of the remarks about Temple Bar?
Well, you know, it's interesting. What do you expect if you go to, I mean, I was in Belgium, as I say, you go to the Grand Place in Belgium and they're hosing it down in the morning. If you go to any central area where young people congregate, there's going to be a fair bit of alcohol and there's going to be boisterousness and exuberance. And that's the reality in every big city. It's not unique to Dublin.
And if it's the tourist centre, there are going to be tourists, which Donal Lynch
makes the
point.
But if you're expecting an authentic
experience,
don't go to Temple Bar. There's so many other fantastic places you can go to. But if you want to go drinking and you want that element of things, well, then go.
But the there's stuff going on there that goes beyond boisterous. Mm. I mean,
a lot of vomiting,
but you could describe that, I suppose, as boisterous. But there's physical violence.
Well, they're throwing chairs.
I mean, it's mad. And I know it stretches a little bit out beyond Temple Bar, but the stuff that's been going on in O'Connell Street in recent times, with supermarkets being barricaded, with staff inside being subjected to racist attack, it's mad stuff.
I think it's great sitting here in RTE and we're all go home to our nice houses and all that. Go down to Temple Bar at 1 o'clock at night to see how bad it is. Go onto YouTube. I spent half an hour watching videos last night. There's people hurling chairs around the place. There's guards like coming. There's 50 people brawls. Like it's horrendous. And like I could not believe the stuff that I was looking at on YouTube last night.
Could you imagine doing that in New York?
I think absolutely. The problem
you could before zero tolerance came in, and then now they have a zero tolerance policy, so nothing more.
Yeah, I think the problem with Temple Bar is it conflates two things. It conflates the cultural quarter. We expect it to be artsy. We expect there to be events there that are family friendly that you can do, and then it's also the party central part of Dublin. So it's conflating two things: the different types of tourists.
Yeah, but firing chairs around isn't really partying, is it?
No.
It's the extreme.
No, but you've got to go back then to the cheap alcohol. You've got to go back to all the promotions that are going on. You can go down and get two cocktails for the price of one. You can.
Sorry, I have no doubt that everybody around the table has taken an alcoholic drink at some stage in life.
No,
without throwing chairs around the place, you know, and some of us might have occasionally had too much and still didn't.
We wouldn't be fit to lift the chair, Marion.
But you look at all those programs on the Spanish resorts, Magaluf, or you know, in Alicante or wherever. I mean, I'm maybe wrongly naming places now, but you know, that is the culture. That is the party central type atmosphere. All I'm saying is I'm not condoning it. I'm just saying we're no different to any other country.
I take the point about New York. You would not do that in New York.
Mm. You would not.
And the other thing is the licence and laws and the rules. Like you were in Belgium. I actually spent time growing up in Belgium, and around the Grand Place is great. Everybody doesn't get kicked out in the street at 2 o'clock at the same time.
Yeah.
I could go to a bar down the place and stay there happily till 7 a.m. and sip my pint quietly. If you take, I don't know how many people go to Temple Bar, thousands, and throw them into the streets at 2 o'clock at the same time full of pints, of course it's going to end in trouble. Like they're all going to try and get taxis, food at the same time, and they're drunk. That's going to cause problems. Like change the licensing laws. Like let people have a pint on Good Friday. Let people, you know, not like going into off licenses and not letting people order a drink. Like if I work all day for 15 hours, which I often do, get home at 10 past 10, I cannot physically buy a beer and take it home to my own house to drink. So like there's a lot of problems with the licensing laws would be the first place to start, I think.
Right, I'm going to have to take a break at some stage here. Just before I do go to the break, this is going back to the charges. Marion, I moved to Northern Ireland 2 years ago and I pay household rates of £1,800 sterling per year, but I don't pay for the following: water, refuse, school books, doctors, hospital visits and prescriptive medicines. Wow. In Edinburgh, 1,300 sterling per year city rates, but no road maintenance, reduced refuse collection, reduced social services, still waiting on an economic upturn here too. And on that note, we'll take a break.
1850 715 150.
The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai. Everyone's talking about the revolution driven by Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, in the Sunday Business Post today, there is an article, not for the first time, except it's kind of stark. And it said, drug price reductions put jobs at risk, says IPHA, which is the Irish Pharmaceutical Healthcare Association. And then they have a little panel about how our generic prices compare after the recent dry price drops. And for cholesterol, statins, and there are an awful lot of people on statins, the Irish price is €5.46 and the British price is €1.53 or £1.26 sterling. And there's another one down there at the bottom, Quetiapine or Seroquel, Irish price €34.80, British price €2.95 in euro or £2.43 in pounds. And the Pharmaceutical Society doesn't, or Pharmaceutical Healthcare Association, thinks that we shouldn't change the prices anymore. Jim Power, what do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, the Irish Pharmaceutical Healthcare Association, it's a mouthful, they have come out and said that if we continue to sell drugs at these very low prices, that it's going to cost jobs, because the view in the industry would be that to develop the drugs, you need to be paid a proper price, and they're not happy.
Yeah, but they go out of patent then.
They're not happy with the reference pricing, because reference pricing looks at a basket of drugs that can treat a certain ailment, and they set an average price for that. But they have included within that, according to this organisation, some drugs that are still on patent, which doesn't make a lot of sense. But anyway, they're not happy with it. They believe it's going to cost jobs. But the other side of the equation then is you've come out with a number of the price comparisons there.
I knew there was a difference. Yeah. But Lord save us, 34.80 versus 2.95.
I have never had that explained properly to me, why that is the case. There are arguments about, you know, Ireland is a tiny market, so you don't get the economies of scale.
Yeah, but then I heard somebody else saying it wasn't to do with economies of scale. Somebody that was in that world.
But those are the arguments that have been thrown at me, and I have yet to get an answer that I find
believable. Most of them are probably made here.
Absolutely.
Another problem with this whole drug business, which we encounter, is the fact that people are now buying these drugs off the internet.
That's what I'm about to say, Marion.
It's absolutely, and what's even worse, sometimes they're sending off money, giving their credit card details to people who they don't even know who they're giving them to. We've had a number of inquiries over the past months where people sent money off to different countries. Well, in a lot of cases, actually, India seems to be the pictures are of people in Canada or people in America or somewhere else, but the actual stuff comes from somewhere in India. Now, the Irish Medicines Board would be pretty hot on this, but the people are actually sending off, they can't afford, if you take Lipitor there, for the top one. I mean, people will send off for those. You look on the internet, type in the word, and up come a whole range of people who you can buy this stuff from at a Mickey Mouse price. And of course, people are going to start buying them in. But what are they actually getting? We don't know what they're getting. It's an awful dangerous thing to be at. We have a big problem here. Unless somebody sorts it out soon, it's going to get worse.
Yeah, it's kind of stark that the HSE is paying more than 10 times more than the National Health Service in the UK for the same drugs. That is a mad situation. But it goes back to many aspects of what has gone on in this country over the last decade. You look at the prices we were paying in our supermarkets, in certain supermarkets that have locations in the UK, we're paying a hell of a lot more here. Likewise on the clothing front. So there's an old vulgar joke that I'm not going to tell on air about why this happens. It's because it can.
But if you look at, we've been talking about this, I mean, I remember the Troika coming in and saying it was unsustainable that we were paying three times more than the UK, our nearest neighbour, for pharmaceutical drugs. We don't seem to be able to get to grips with it. And James Riley has come out a number of times with initiatives on this, and yet nothing ever seems to change. And I saw a statistic that we spend 13% of our health budget on payments for drugs to pharmacists. It's 1.9 billion a year. Is what we spend. Now, in a time where we're doing cutbacks and there's a lot of anecdotal evidence about very unfair removals of medical cards to people, surely this is something we should be tackling rather than, you know, really affecting people where...
Niall, I wonder if what you say doesn't have some relevance, though. You know, they're probably made here. They are made here, to the best of my knowledge. And that might be a political reason why the government doesn't want to cut the deal that they should cut, because they're afraid not what's happening to the pharmacies or that, but what might happen to the industry.
Yeah, but I mean, look, if they're it's the same as the tech companies being here, if they're willing to come and work here, like, Ireland is such a minuscule part of their market, like, we should be able to cut some sort of deal to get cheap drugs off them. Like there's a lot of execs in big companies, like in the telcos, in the supermarkets, in clothing companies that refer to Ireland as Treasure Island because they can make so much money here, and Irish people are stupid enough to keep on paying it. And we do. We talk about it, but we keep on paying stupid prices, and those drugs will probably be the same price in 2 or 3 years' time. So it's up to ourselves. Like, we need to push back and stop paying the prices.
I think that's a factor for patients themselves on the other end of the spectrum. Of some people are looking at the internet to find cheaper ones, but there are also some people who generics are poorly explained or poorly communicated, so they're not they're still buying Lipitor instead of buying the generic, which is much cheaper.
There is now a legal obligation. There is a legal obligation, yeah.
But a lot of patients still won't take them. They're used to their Lipitor, they're used to the branding, they're used to the box, and they're not quite trusting of the generic.
But the patient then has to pay the difference.
Yes, the patient has to.
But if you look at your price differences there, you'd nearly be as well off to get yourself on a plane or a boat and go over and buy your year's supply in Britain and come back here. I mean,
but people do.
Yeah, they do.
People are doing that already.
People are going north, particularly to do
people who go on holidays to Spain and France or other places. When people go to Spain, you can buy a lot of these for a quarter, maybe a fifth of the price in Spain, and people are coming back with them to get their year supply in Spain and while they're on holidays.
Which is concerning as well because you do want monitoring of it. You do want a pharmacist you can go back to and ask if there are any side effects or anything else. So, you know, buying them out of the country in a sense is almost like buying them off the internet. There's no comeback for the purchaser.
Right, yeah. Listen, just I'm watching my clock here and I wanted to run across two things. The articles in the paper yesterday in the Irish Times, Tom Lyons' article, and then there was more in the Sindo today. Did we learn anything new, Jim?
Out of the Anglo trials and so on?
No, not the Anglo trials. The guarantees, the night of the guarantees.
Oh, sorry. No, no, not at all. I don't think so. I mean, I think...
Not new to you that the central bank and or the regulator, I can't remember which one, had asked both AIB and Bank of Ireland to put money into Anglo?
No.
No.
I've known that for some time. I mean, my understanding was that that was out there.
It was in Tom Lyons' book.
It was, wasn't it? Yeah,
that certainly didn't come as a surprise to me.
Yeah. So did we learn anything at all?
I don't think so. No, I mean, the thing was a total fiasco. It was a total shambles. There was nobody in charge. The people in power were on the bank side of the table and they pulled all the strings. They got the outcome they wanted and the rest of us ended up picking up the price. That's the reality.
And they still are.
And they still are,
look at the banks when they go into the Dáil committees and they don't answer the questions. Culture eats strategy for breakfast. It's that Peter Drucker management quote. The culture hasn't changed at all. And they're still, I mean, Michael Lewis has written this book, Flash Boys, about the way they're doing it now, how they're getting around things with algorithms.
He's really terrifically good.
But there isn't a will to tackle the corruption on an international scale, and that's the problem.
Okay, we are just coming up to 12 o'clock and I remind our audience that with us in studio, Niall Harbison, Philip McCabe, Noreen Hegarty, Jim Parr and Sinead O'Carroll. And now we go to the newsroom and Kate Carolan.